she inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. This is Gina Murphy, darling, and you are listening to Mrs. Green's World, an inspirational and informative place where we'd never tell you what to think. We just want you to, and the world is calling for lots of thinking these days. Thanks so much for joining us and for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. And as always, I do a shout out to one of the sponsors who helps make the Mrs. Green's World show happen and is supportive of our mission and vision. And for this day, it's the Chapman Automotive Group. I have a little green highlight about Chapman that really matters. One of their facilities has received a platinum level Honda Environmental Leadership Award for reduction of 50% in energy use. And it was one of only 14 dealerships in the country to be given this award in recognition of their sustainability programs. It's not just that they reduced energy use. They have an amazing community green team. And we are doing lots of amazing things that impact the planet and the community. And it is one of the many reasons why we are proud to be partnering with them and applaud them for the difference that they are making. So thank you, Chapman. Now, please join me in welcoming our in-studio guest. And I always love when we have an in-studio guest because I do so many phone calls remotely. Our guest is Ron Guerin. He is many things, trust me. He's a social entrepreneur, a humanitarian, writer, artist, public speaker. And he is also a highly decorated fighter pilot and test pilot. And you know, Ron, I was reading about this and I thought, it's kind of like having Superman sit here. I don't know if anybody's ever called you Superman.
No,
I'm like,
never.
Yeah, he does. It was making me laugh in a very good way. He believes that appropriately designed and targeted social enterprise can solve many of the problems facing our world. He is currently the chief pilot for Worldview Enterprises, which we're going to hear about, a pioneering high altitude and space company headquartered right here in Tucson, Arizona, bringing communications, technology, sensors, and passengers to the edge of space. And I mean the edge of space. And then I kind of saved this for last, and I had to put it in here. The big deal here is that he's a retired NASA astronaut who has traveled, and I read this, and I'm like, what? 71 million miles. This is what I read on your website, so it better be true. In 2,842 orbits of our planet, during more than 178 days in space. I mean, the man sitting here has experienced things that we may have dreamed about or thought about or had incredible fright about, because it's like just going up there is courageous. So Ron, thanks for being here and sharing this hour with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Gina. Thanks
really,
for having me.
Really exciting for me. And I want to go back to, I saw you speak at Fast Pitch, which is a wonderful...
It's
a wonderful event here in Tucson that's was started by Social Venture Partners. And I said to my friends who were sitting with me, we have to get Ron on the show. So I literally stalked you in the parking lot. I ran out and I said, Ron, you know, I'm Mrs. Green. And obviously that worked. That was successful because here you are. But I thought about the political climate then, which was we were in the debate time and there was lots of conversations. And the reason I wanted to have you on the show is because of your message of the key is we, of what you saw in space and what crystallized for you at a very pivotal moment. I mean, you got us there for what happened to you when you looked down on the Earth from space and outside of the space shuttle, which I was like, oh my God, yes, he was. So to fast forward to now, and in some ways to me, it's even more critical what your message is, because the divisiveness is worse in our country, especially, and in many places around the world, if we don't have the corner on divisiveness and pain and vitriol, and everybody knows what the political climate has done to divide families and friends and companies and the parties. So I'm glad you're here now, and I'd love you to do most of the talking. That was my long introduction, but I'd like you to just share with people what you saw. And not only saw, but here we're sitting here, that was 2008, and it's almost 2018. So almost a decade that has become so integral to your life's work. So now it's going to be all about you, what you saw and how what you're doing is all towards the healing.
Mm-hmm. All right.
How's that for taking a deep breath?
Yeah. I don't know where to start. Maybe just to share some of the perspectives that and experiences that I've had that really shaped my view of the planet that we live on. You know, as you said, I flew in space. I flew twice. I flew once in 2008, and that was on board the space shuttle. It was a two-week construction mission to the International Space Station. So we brought up and installed the Japanese laboratory, the biggest laboratory on the space station. And over the course of those 2 weeks in space, I did three spacewalks in support of the construction. In 2011, I spent half of 2011 living and working on board the International Space Station.
It blew me away. Yeah. That's thus that you were booking those miles.
Well, I didn't get frequent flyer miles credit for that. Or, you know, in the old days in the military, we used to get 5 cents a mile for TD, you know, for travel, but we didn't get that either. But what was interesting about that half year in space was, that was after I launched from Kazakhstan in a Russian rocket with two Russian military officers. And what was really interesting about that was I spent the first 15 years of my adult life training to fight the Russians. I was a Cold War fighter pilot on the tip of the sword there in West Germany at the time. And to find myself at the base of a rocket that would take us to space from a previous top-secret Soviet military installation. On the 50th anniversary of the first flight of a human, Yuri Gagarin, from the very same launch pad that he launched from, as a fully integrated member of a Russian spacecraft crew, and I look up at this rocket that's going to take us to space, and there's an American flag on it. And, you know, it's an emotional experience to you know, be about to launch into space. But I think seeing the American flag next to a Russian flag on this rocket was the overwhelming emotional experience I had, because what it represented to me was the power of what we can do, what we can accomplish when we set aside our differences and we work together. We agree to work together. And in this particular case, it's working together towards making the world a better place. And so I've had a number of really incredible experiences, both good and bad, that have shaped my view of the planet. My first NASA mission was not in space. My first NASA mission was on the bottom of the ocean. I spent 3 weeks.
I read that too. And I'm like, oh yeah, he's an aquanaut too.
But I mean, that, you know, 3 weeks on the bottom of the ocean, living in a beautiful coral reef off the coast of Key Largo, was an incredible experience. And it really changed, completely, utterly changed my perspective of the oceans. I have flown in combat. I was a combat fighter pilot in Desert Storm in the first Gulf War. So I think I've had the opportunity to see the best and the worst of what humanity has to offer. And I think that's really kind of shaped my outlook on things.
And part of what matters to me and why it was so important for me to have you here and spend this time, think of what you just said, because I am sitting here thinking about it. You do bring many perspectives that, is there anybody else even on the planet? You know, I don't want to go goo-goo gaga, but the importance of your message, because of what you saw in the oceans, look at the shape they're in right now. Coral reefs, oh, what are they? Someday our kids might say that. And then what's happening with Russia today. And that's what I was trying to convey about the timeliness of your being here and the messages that you'll be able to share with the thousands of people who listen to this podcast and can take something so positive and so hopeful away from it, because you really did go from the depths of the oceans up to space and are spending your time right here on Earth.
Yeah, I think in some respect, what I experienced through those experiences is a veil being lifted and truth being exposed, the true reality of the world that we live in, the true interrelated, interdependent nature of our world was really made clear.
So, and you do say a lot in the writing and in the sites I visited and the things that I've read that you've written, there's a phrase that comes out a lot, and it's collaboration is key. And it's not just forming a little, you know, partnership here and a handshake. I mean, collaboration is sometimes difficult, mm-hmm. challenging, mm-hmm. but it is key. So can you just expand on that a little bit more about collaboration is key in the deepest sense?
Yeah, I think it really, this idea of the need for a deeper level of collaboration really became clear while I was in space. And I launched into space with a belief that we already, right now, today, have all the technology, all the resources necessary to solve many, if not all, the problems facing our planet. And I got into this routine while I was on the space station where I would almost say goodnight to the Earth. When it was time to get ready for bed, when all my tasks were over, I would go to this place called the Cupola. And the Cupola is this windowed observatory on the bottom of the space station. It faces the Earth. And I would just Earth gaze for a while. And, you know, just floating there, you know, detached from the planet, looking at this incredibly beautiful sight was awe-inspiring. And that's why I did almost every day I would spend some time just, you know, looking back at the Earth. And what would always happen is I would always be hit in the gut with the sobering contradiction between the beauty of our planet, the indescribable beauty of our planet, and the unfortunate realities of life on our planet for a very significant number of its inhabitants. And as I would take in this beautiful scene, and as I would ponder this contradiction, I would think about what the future would be like. What's the next 50 years, 100 years going to look like? How far would we progress in solving and overcoming the challenges facing our planet? And what became clear to me is, you know, going back to that original statement that I believe that we already have the technology and resources necessary to solve the problem. If that's true, I pondered the question, why do we still have them?
Right, right.
And the answer that I think hit me was we still have them because we have not learned to date how to effectively work together as a planetary civilization. You know, there's good news and there's bad news here. The good news is, by far, the vast number of people in the world want to make a positive difference. They want to leave this place a little bit better than we found.
I do believe that.
Regardless of what you see in the news doesn't focus on those folks. The news focuses on the folks that are not...
Right, making the negative noise.
Right, and that's what sells, right? So that's what you hear. So the vast majority of the people in the world want to make a difference. And this is represented in the fact that there's over 20 million organizations around the world that have a charter to improve life on Earth, environmental, social, you know, all these different organizations. The bad news is, for the most part, these organizations are not engaged in a unified, coordinated effort. There's tremendous duplication of effort. There's tremendous loss of efficiency. There's a tremendous loss of the good that these organizations could accomplish if they learned to work together. And even worse than that, there's something that I call destructive competition, right? Competition is good. Competition leads to better goods and services, but destructive competition does not. Destructive competition is where organizations cut corners, they spread rumors. And in the humanitarian sector, when I started in the humanitarian sector, I naively thought that everybody was in it to do good. And if another organization could, let's say, provide water better than this organization, then, you know, go for it. We should, you know, we're all just trying to provide clean water, right? But there's a lot of pressures that are put on organizations. They all live in a universe of finite funding. They're all vying for the same grants and the same funding. And there's an incredible lack of, I don't want to say transparency, but there's an incredible lack of credentialed information, right? Peer-reviewed data. It's very easy for an organization to say, you know, we're doing all this amazing stuff. We've put in 5,000 hand pumps to provide water. But what they don't tell you is out of the 5,000, maybe 1,000 still work. And so it's incredibly easy to paint a much more positive picture by these organizations than the reality. And there is this destructive competition that exists out there. And if we were able to rise above that, if we were able to see that for what it is and to see that we still face all these seemingly intractable problems because we as a species have not learned how to fully cooperate. And it goes beyond, you know, politics. It goes beyond national borders. It's just a problem that we have yet to fully overcome.
And it speaks volumes about the word that keeps coming up for me is the deeper collaboration. I watched a movie. I've watched it twice. I highly recommend it. It's called Poverty Inc. I'm spreading the word about it. And part of the message, the most important part of the message of this movie, which how do we get it out there, is those organizations, so many of those NGOs, the nonprofit sector, the environmental organizations, the only way, if we just take poverty, because this one is about poverty, the only way to get people out of poverty is to help teach them how. That's how you end poverty. And as a global community, even in the Western world especially, we think, oh my gosh, there's a disaster in Haiti. Let's send them rice. Let's send them solar panels. Let's send them shoes.
But you know what's the key, the word that you said, which is the problem? Them.
Yes.
That's
yes.
The key. There's not them, it's us.
That's really a good point. And I talked to the producer of the movie because I said, oh, this is a give a man a fish and you feed him for a day, feed him to fish, you teach him to fish and you feed him for life. He goes, yeah, Gina, there's another part to that. You have to have them have access to the pond. Mm-hmm. Because in many cases, they don't even have access to the pond. But that's a really good point. It's there isn't a them, and it's not collaborative. It's us thinking what they need instead of saying, we're here, we can help, what can we do? And that's a true collaboration. It's not us mm-hmm. as in them.
Yeah, of course.
We have the money, maybe. Sometimes we have the power or the education. But what I found out from this movie, so succinctly put, without blame, shame, and guilt, is that there are destructive things that come about as a result of our philanthropy or our charitable giving and destroy communities because, you know, rice farmers don't need 2,000 tons of rice delivered in a year because then they don't have any jobs. So it's, I mean, I think it's a really critical point.
Well, I think, another good point that you brought out there is our definition of the word home. Right? Because our definition of the word home has tremendous implications for how we solve problems, how we treat each other, how we treat our planet. And one of the things that's really easy to do when you're in space is have this idea of home rapidly expand to encompass the whole planet. And by doing so, we don't lose where we came from. We don't lose our hometown. We don't lose our nationality.
Right.
We broaden it and we put it in the context of that. And when we hear about a natural disaster or a man-made disaster somewhere in the world and we think, oh, those poor people over there, we're missing the point. It's not those poor people over there. That's us. That's part of the human family. And whatever happens to one of us happens to all of us. And I don't just mean that philosophically. It's reality. That really happens. I mean, ripples and waves go out in every direction from anything good that happens or anything bad that happens, and it affects everybody on the planet to some extent or another.
But what is the, you talk about barriers. That is so true. That is not an alt fact. That is true. It's absolutely true. And what is the our evolution, if you will, of that we are so segregated and segmented and polarized in the opposite of that in many cases, even for someone like me, that I care deeply, you're bringing me to another level of thinking that it is all about us. It is us. There is no them. And I say that, I mean, one of the perfect examples that popped into my mind is Fukushima. People, if you think Fukushima isn't impacting our planet in every way today, the ripple effect of that will be felt for the rest of my life and many lives after that. And it's not in the news. And what about all those people? Here I am saying it again. What about the people there that are suffering beyond measure? It's not even a news item. You can't find anything written about Fukushima except for some of the diehards that want to keep the conversation going. So it's illustrative of your point big time. And that shift in mindset, I don't want to think that way. I want to think of the Haitians as they're part of my planet and they're part of the world that I want to see, you know, get better. So we just got the 1 minute warning, which I told you it would fly, and we'll take a short break. And there's a lot more that I want to talk about, especially taking this a little bit deeper level, because another thing that you say is talk is wonderful. Discussions about collaboration is key. The key is we, but putting those things into action. Mm-hmm. And I think that you have examples of what has worked, and give us some of those examples, because people, when I say we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to, well, people want to know a call to action. And changing your mindset about how we view the planet is really a good one. But let's, when we come back, let's talk about some of the ways to make this meaningful and roll it out into meaningful action. Everybody, stay here with me. We'll be right back with Ron Guerin.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. I am Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thank you so much for being with us. And I am sure if you have tuned in, you are happy to be with us. Joining me for this hour is for our Earth Day show, which I think is so appropriate. And we have with us one of the very few human beings on the planet who has actually viewed this great planet of ours from space, and who actually had a moment in his life about 10 years ago while up in space. He called it a hit in the gut with an undeniable sobering contradiction, and it has had a major impact on his life's work, obviously. And, you know, there are all of the things that I said about him at the top of the show, about being a social entrepreneur, humanitarian, writer, artist, public speaker. And what I would like to add to that list, Ron, and I think it should be at the top of the list, is thought leader. We need more thought leaders.
No, we need more action leaders.
Okay, here you go again. I love it. Okay, we need action leaders. That's a quotable, that's a great tweet. We don't need more thought leaders. We meet. It's so true. It's like thinking is great. Now what are we going to do about it? So talk to us about that.
Yeah, so maybe to build a little foundation, because before the break, you basically asked me, you know, how do we get outside of this thinking of us versus them? You know, how do we break down these barriers? And I think part of the path to do that is to realize the filters and perspectives that we erect, the fictions that we erect in our own lives. And when we look at the world is a very complicated, complex place. There's, you know, all these horrors. There's terrorism, there's environmental disasters, there's crime, there's violence, there's war, all these negative things. But the world is also characterized by love and compassion and generosity and innovation and creativity. And so what we tend to do, what everybody tends to do, myself included, is take this really, really complicated, complex world and boil it down to something simpler. To put it into these, to build some filters, basically, to make sense, to make this world more
powerful. Even manageable in our minds.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And in the process of doing that, what we tend to do is we tend to lump groups, situations, individuals into the cubbyholes of our artificially constructed framework, right? And if you take that to the extreme, we start lumping groups and nations and religions and ethnicities into these cubbyholes, and then erect boundaries and borders. We're boxing them in, and we're boxing ourselves in. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with identifying with a particular group. You know, we tend to put ourselves in some of these boxes,
totally,
too. But there is a problem if that defines who we're willing to talk to, who we're willing to work with, who we're willing to collaborate with, who we consider part of our human family. And it's gotten so bad in our present American political situation that one group will refuse to see any merit whatsoever in the opinions and proposed solutions of the other group. If we acknowledge any merit whatsoever, then they will win and we will lose. It's a zero-sum game, right? That's not the way the world actually works. And so the first step to be able to have real, tangible, meaningful, impactful action is to realize the filters and the boundaries that we've established in our own minds and our own lives through which we view the world in. And when I said there's a group, I'm not talking about a specific group. They all do it.
I get it. We all do it.
We all do it. And so the first step to true effective collaboration is to break down those boundaries and borders. And one of the ways you do that is by your perspective. You know, and one of the best ways to have a very effective perspective is to zoom out to the largest geographic area possible, ideally the entire planet, and to zoom out to the longest timeline possible. So the reason why I'm saying that is there's many well-meaning organizations and groups that have come into a specific area to do some good in that area, but they didn't realize that they were causing harm elsewhere.
Right.
There's some very well-meaning groups that come into a specific area and they do tremendous good in the short term, but they leave in the long term, they leave the very people that they're trying to help worse off than if they had never come in the first place. And so we are very, very short-sighted. We seem to get more short-sighted every day. And a lot of the decisions that are being made, both on a national and a global scale, are only taking the next shareholders report, the next election cycle in view, when the solutions that we need are solutions that have to last for years and decades or centuries. And we're not thinking about that. We're not thinking about our grandchildren. We're thinking about, you know, 3 weeks
from now. The next quarterly earnings.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, one of the things that happened for me was I went to this workshop last summer called Cultivating Women's Leadership, and I was really happy to get in, and we had to do some homework, and I had to watch a film. It was a TED Talk about white privilege, and I was like, the voices in my head, well, you know, I'm not racist, I'm not prejudiced, blah, 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 and all my defenses were up, mm-hmm. And I'm like, so then I took a deep breath, I listened, and I got to understand that white privilege is not something that we choose. If you're born white in this world, you have white privilege. It's not bad. It's not good. Just an awareness of it. And Ron, I will tell you, there have been conversations that I've had, even as recently as a couple of weeks ago, where I said something and I realized that was my perspective as a white middle-class woman living in Tucson, Arizona. And it wasn't mean-spirited or prejudice. It was that consciousness that you're talking about of these things that are patterns that are put in us or that we have created that need to be just re-looked at and re-evaluated and change that.
But the key thing that you said there is that you realized it. And so the first step to being able to have effective collaboration is to realize the filters that you have put and the perspectives that you have. You can't escape that you have certain perspectives that have been shaped by your experiences and your life, and we all do. But we can't think that that's the extent of the universe, that, you know, our universe ends at, you know, the next town.
Right.
Because it doesn't. And we all have our different perspectives, but we have one reality, right? We're all living in the same real world. And so to solve the very real problems we have, which are not two-dimensional problems, we have to live in the real multi-dimensional, very complex world that we're in. And, you know, they can't always be reduced to sound bites, the solutions.
And the question I have for you, and I hope it's like a whirling dervish question. So thinking about our current very painful political situation here in America that the world is watching, when you talk about action, for someone like me that wants to go more towards the healing and collaborative working together, really, you know, we had a show that I did yesterday and I thought, I better say this. I'm not attacking Republicans or, you know, supporting Democrats. What I'm talking about is a cause that affects all of us, and it's a collaborative process. And you can't paint everybody, Republican or Democrat, with the same brush no matter what. So when you talk about action, mm-hmm. and I think about this world, my world right now here in the United States of America, what can we put into action as citizens that moves towards that world that you're talking about? Because that world works for everyone. That's a concept that people don't even talk about. How do we start that path to consciousness? There are thousands of people that listen to the show. And it's like, Ron, tell us a couple of first steps
sure.
of awareness, because there are lots of people that wanted to heal and get better. I don't want to die sad. That's what I say to my husband all the time. I'm 66 years old. I don't want to die sad. I want to die happy because of the changes and the contributions and on and on. So talk to us about that.
So that's a great question, and there's a lot of aspects to that question. So I'll start out by saying that every single one of us on this planet is probably considerably more powerful than we ever could realize.
I agree. I do.
And the reason why I think we don't realize that, and the reason why I think some people are hesitant to make a difference, just take positive action, is because they don't realize that they can make a difference. And part of that reason we alluded to is this short attention span, is we want results right now. We want to save the world right now. And a really good way to illustrate this is to consider that an asteroid was coming towards the Earth, a killer asteroid. It's big enough that it would wipe out every living thing on the planet if it hit the Earth. So if we knew about this asteroid far enough out, we wouldn't have to send Bruce Willis and a team of heroes to go blow it out of the sky. We could send a small spacecraft, and with the force equivalent of a feather, give the asteroid just a little nudge. But that nudge, over the course of the time that it traveled to the Earth, could result in thousands of miles of missed distance, saving every living thing on the planet. So at the end of the day, every day, all we need to do is make sure that our nudges, we have more positive nudges than negative nudges, because everything we say, everything we do, everything we think, it not only impacts the trajectory of our own lives, but in some way affects the trajectory of the entire world. Sometimes, you know, very large, and sometimes very small. But there is an effect. And so as long as we're making more positive nudges than negative nudges, then that's all that could be asked for us. So when you look at things over a long time frame, we are incredibly powerful because we are making these nudges. We're changing the trajectory of our planet, of our world, of our civilization with everything that we do. So that's one part of that, the thing to think about.
And very hopeful.
Right. And how do we get together? We have all this divisiveness, not just in America, but all around the world. There's hypernationalism, tribalism, parochialism, all these isms that are basically descriptive of people putting walls up and separating into camps. So how do we overcome that? One of the first steps to overcoming that after we realize these filters is to establish the goals of decisions and the framework that we're going to apply to decisions and courses of action. Right. So I wrote this book called The Orbital Perspective. I'm teaching this massive open online course called Introduction to the Orbital Perspective.
And that's called a MOOC?
It's a MOOC.
MOOC,
yeah.
I learned a new word today, hashtag MOOC. I'm going to be Googling what that all is,
and
but
it just started, and we already have people from 38 different countries taking the course. But part of that is decision-making. And so there's five steps to effective decision-making from the orbital perspective. The first one is the decision based on the most peer-reviewed, credentialed scientific data available? Are we using the best truth data we have available
to us
at the time? Because if we have the best data, then we can make the best long-term prediction on the course that this decision is going to take us on. What's the change in trajectory? So that's the first thing. The second thing is, does the decision or course of action create harm elsewhere beyond the area of concern? And so a decision from the orbital perspective at a minimum would be neutral outside the area of concern. Ideally, it would be positive and restorative. Okay. The third step is, would the decision or the course of action survive being put in a spotlight? Or does it require secrecy to be successful? If it's not an open and transparent decision, then because it violates one of the other principles of decisions from the orbital perspective, then it's going to be counterproductive and destructive in the long term. The next one is, does the decision consider the long-term effects? If we project the results and the implications of a decision out to our grandchildren's generation, is it positive or restorative, or is it causing harm? If we're causing harm to our grandchildren, then we're sacrificing our prodigy for short-term financial gains, you know. And part of that is our party loyalty, our parochial and tribal factors taking a priority over the greater good, you know. For instance, in America, our, you know, maintaining party loyalty is just more important than the overall benefit and well-being of our nation. And the last thing is, Does the decision take into account the priorities, planet, society, economy, or economy, society, planet? So one of the truths that's really obvious from space is when you look out the window of the International Space Station, or when I looked out the window of the International Space Station, I didn't see the economy. I saw an iridescent biosphere teeming with life. And what is obvious from that perspective is that the economy is the wholly owned subsidiary of the biosphere. It's the wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. But because our political systems, our business systems treat it exactly opposite, we see that we're living a lie. So one of the first ways to be able to flip our perspective is to flip our perspective from thinking that everything is that the economy is the end-all be-all to that this idea that the economy exists within our civilization, which is completely dependent and a part of the biosphere that we call Earth. Because, you know, a really good example of this is, let's say, climate change, right? You know what the first victim of climate change is going to be? The economy. So it's
and that is a fact. That is absolutely and positively the truth. When these things have happened of late, it's like, don't people understand that if you deplete the resources, that's the answer? It's depleted. It's done. So much for your earnings per share. That is not a political view of mine. It's a true observation of what it's the observation of what you're saying. We will be destroying things that made us profit.
Right. So let me give you an example. If some government organization had $100 million to invest in research, and they decided to invest in exploration for new oil reserves, and we are successful, so we invest $100 million, we find the new oil reserves, and we get to tap those oil reserves, we're tapping those oil reserves at the expense of our grandchildren. We're taking the resources that they possibly could have had, and we're moving it forward, and we're using it. If you took that same $100 million and you invested it in research for new effective ways to do solar energy, then we're getting the benefit, the same benefit, we're getting the energy, but it's at the benefit of our grandchildren because they're going to get to use it as well, and they're going to build on that. So it's just shifting your mindset of it's not, you know, the economy versus the environment, it's both. I mean, we can grow our economy, we can create jobs, we can create new exciting products, and we can do that in such a way that doesn't harm the planet, that doesn't harm any people or any other species that we share the planet with.
And there can be profit.
Yeah, that's it. It has to be.
Yeah, it is. There has to be. I mean, so it's not mutually exclusive. When you go through those five steps and you, as a deep thinker, see what's happening in the current political situation, and climate change is a perfect example. And I don't want to polarize or politicize the conversation, but that test was clearly not applied in any of the executive orders that are going to undo so much of the good that this the direction in which this country has been going since the 70s. Mm-hmm. So where's that test in Washington, D.C.? Did you send them a copy of the test they should take for making decisions based on these five things?
I have no idea how decisions are made in Washington. I can tell you how it appears to be made. It appears to be made by special interest groups that are pumping billions and billions of dollars into our political process. And all you have to do is follow the money. And decisions are being made because lobbyists are buying them, basically.
If it's not about the money, it's about the money. I've been doing this for 10 years, and many times after the show, we both put our heads down on the studio desk and say, if it's not about the money, it's about the money. It's impacting that. Let's go to something that you have seen where what you're talking about has been successful. You do support projects. I can't imagine how sought after you are to share the word, the key is we, help lead people in the right direction. What you're doing with the MOOC is another example. Is that a good one, example of how you put the thought into action and create a community that's really focused on change. And of course, we have 1 minute to go. I always do this. I ask that critical question, but guess what? We'll take a break.
Stay tuned. We will remember.
Stay tuned. Everybody hang on the edge of your seat because we will have the answer. And to me, that was about, I think of these segments and time warp and time speeding, because it's really, it's good stuff that you're talking about. And I can't reiterate this enough, the timeliness of this and our team's commitment will be strong to share this so that more and more people can listen, because it is, if we flip one person, the world changes. Mm-hmm. That's what we have to think about. If I change my mind and start showing up in a very different way, the world has changed already. It's different. Okay, Exactly. Everybody, stay here with me. Hang on the edge of your seats. We're going to hear about putting these things into action. We'll be right back.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World, and thank you for being a part of our world. We are spending this hour with Ron Guerin. He is a fighter pilot, test pilot, explorer, aquanaut, and astronaut, and truly a humanitarian who believes that appropriately designed and targeted social enterprise can solve many of the problems facing our world. And he has given us many examples of that. He has spent an incredible amount of time in space as an astronaut with people from Russia. If you heard the beginning part of this powerful podcast, you hear that, and I reiterate the timeliness of it. So what we were doing when we last spoke was talking about an example of the action piece that is critical, because thoughts are great and a dime a dozen, but unless you wake to make those dreams possible, not much has changed.
Sure. So I think probably the best example I could think of setting aside differences and coming together and doing something amazing is the International Space Station itself. And, you know, back when there was the debate on whether or not to allow the Russians to join the space station program, there was a lot of political bickering. There was a lot of people who thought, you know, we disagree with Russia on X, Y, and Z, and until we, you know, get them to see it our way, that we have no business doing anything with those folks, right? But we didn't go down that path. What we did instead is we found something that we did agree on, in this case, space exploration, and we decided to work on that. And so the International Space Station is 15 nations. That's the partnership. And, you know, the significance of this really hit me on a spacewalk. On a spacewalk on my first mission, I was had my feet strapped to the end of the space station's robotic arm, and with me attached to the arm, it was flown through a maneuver we called the windshield wiper. So at the top of this windshield wiper, I was 100 feet above the space station, looking down at this incredible accomplishment of humanity against the backdrop of our indescribably beautiful planet 240 miles below, and the scene was breathtaking. But what hit me more than the beauty of the scene was the incredible human accomplishment that the International Space Station represented. Like I said, 15 nations came together, built it. Some of these nations weren't always the best of friends. They're on opposite sides of the Cold War, opposite sides of the space race. So going back to bringing the Russians into the space station program, when we made that decision, what we did is we started working on this thing that we agreed on. And because of that, personal relationships developed, a certain level of trust developed, and we became really a finely oiled machine. We did something. We built arguably the most complicated, complex structure ever built. We built it in space. It's this amazing accomplishment, but what's more amazing than that is the platform that has created. So now because we chose something that we agreed on to work on together, and all these things and this level of trust developed, that becomes a platform that we can jump off from to address the things that we don't agree on. Now, let's look at the present political situation in Russia at the moment. They're in the news every day, right? And so...
And it's all fear-based.
It's all fear-based.
It's right. All fear-based.
Fear is the most divisive, powerful force on the planet, and there's a lot of people who profit from spinning up fear, and a lot of people who profit from creating division. That's a very short-sighted way to do things. But when we were on the international, people have asked me, did you talk about politics on the International Space Station? And I can honestly say I don't ever remember having a political conversation on the space station, not because it was forbidden, because it was irrelevant.
Right. There were more important things to talk about.
There were more important things to do. And so
and do.
When things like this happen on the space station, they're like, oh, those earthlings, they're at it again. You know, they don't understand how, you know, we as humans are supposed to work with each other. And so I think both literally and figuratively, the International Space Station rises above that political bickering. So now we have to figure out a way to take this level of collaboration, to take this example of the International Space Station and bring it down to the surface of the Earth and put it in the context of our rapidly developing, hyper-interconnected society. You know, back 100 years ago, maybe you could get away with being an isolationist and think we just live on our little island here. That world doesn't exist anymore. We are completely interdependent. We are completely interconnected. And what happens on one side of the planet affects what happens, whether it's environmental, or political, economic, cultural, et cetera.
And one of the things you said just right before we went back on air is there is a difference. And this is the paradigm shift. You shifted another one for me that we all need to remember. The Russian politicians are not the Russian people. It's not exactly what you said, but the government is not the people. So there are people.
And that applies to us as
well. It is to us, exactly. It's like, don't define me by that. But it's thinking about they are human beings and they are, you know, there's so many commonalities, more commonalities.
Well, that's why I stress personal relationships develop. When you realize, oh, they have the same desires and wants and goals and objectives. And in this particular case, it was to explore space. And, the true reality of the world that we live in is we have tremendously more in common than what separates us. But we tend to focus on our differences. And the differences aren't bad. The diversity, when you apply diversity to problem solving, you get better solutions. Diversity is a strength. The differences that we have are not, you know, wedges to drive us apart. They're strengths that if we can combine them and see, when you see a problem from a slightly different perspective, your problem solving is a lot more powerful and effective.
And it is aha moments. If you can do that. I know one of the things that I was in conflict resolution for all the emotions I have about what's going on is an invitation to spend some time with a person that you know has really diametrically opposed views as you do. And I did it. And it's someone that I love. And I asked her, you know, how could she have supported this candidate? And, you know, she has daughters and on and on and on. And we didn't budge much. I can honestly say that. It was what was very clear to me is she valued things that I don't and vice versa. More. You know what I mean? It was like, and we're, yeah. So we're the friendship is there, but there was an aha moment for me about what her fears were, what she cares about, and it was a cause for me to do some deeper thinking.
Well, going back to, you know, when we talked about these cubbyholes in our constructed framework, each of those cubbyholes has a label on it. And so the worst thing we can do is when you have somebody who disagrees with your viewpoint, with your perspective, is to then, oh, they go into this box.
Yes.
Let me put them in this box right
here.
We do
it automatically. You're right. We do.
Because that what a box does, a box has walls, right? And so we've just separated ourselves from that person. And we've basically said, you know, their opinion is not worth it. And there's a lot of labels getting thrown around. And our media amplifies those labels and really uses them as tools in a very, very divisive way.
So one of the things that I think is helpful to that I've shared with people is be in a media blackout, because that's not the way that you get real news, or find a news source that you trust that helps. But really get engaged in what is it that matters to you, and then define your call to action. And I think one of the things that I feel is a positive about what's going on is that people are really saying, what do I care about? What do I want to fight for? What do I want to be a stand for? What's worth marching about? And usually, if it's marching for something as opposed to against something, that's when we all win. I want to march for educating girls. I want to march for, schools, the schools that my kids go to. There's so many things. If you're coming from a place of what you want instead of what you're against, I think that's a helpful way to approach it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what about, we've not talked 1 minute about worldview, which is what you're doing now. And yeah. I think we should throw that in a little bit. And then, of course, I want to get to the little teaser you gave me earlier, because what you have shared with us now puts it into perspective about all of these people that have been in space, that are astronauts, that have that perspective, and what might come about for our world as a result of that. So tell us about worldview.
Yeah, so worldview is a natural progression from my motivation for leaving NASA. So I left NASA in 2013, and I left with the objective, of the sole reason really, to be able to share this perspective of our planet that I have, that I've been given, with as many people as I could, unencumbered, full-time. And so everything I did since leaving NASA was done with the motive to figuratively transport people to a higher vantage point, to figuratively transport people to a vantage point where all the pieces of the puzzle come into view, and you could kind of make sense of what's going on. So I wrote the book, The Orbital Perspective. I'm teaching a course, Introduction to the Orbital Perspective. I'm working on a full-length feature documentary. I paint oil paintings that try and depict that. About a year and a half ago, I was offered an opportunity to come work for Worldview. And now, since joining Worldview as the chief pilot, I'm no longer confined to just figuratively transporting people. I can literally transport people to this higher vantage point.
Yeah.
So Worldview is a really interesting company because it has really two forked approach to their business. One is to create unmanned systems. So basically anything that you can do with a satellite, we can do with what's called a stratolite. Many, many orders of magnitude, less expensive, quicker, in a lot of cases better. So it's going to change everything. It's going to completely change communications. It's going to completely change how we predict weather. It's going to completely change anything that has to do with Earth observations, with being able to provide internet, with fire warnings. It's going to change everything, and it's really, really exciting. But then the other part is flying people. And so we fly people and these other packages under high altitude balloons up to the stratosphere, up to a point where you see the curvature of the Earth, you see the blackness of the sky, you see how unbelievably, incredibly thin the atmosphere is, that's the number one thing I think people are going to, when they see the atmosphere, because right when we look at the sky from the ground, it's the big blue sky. You couldn't possibly put enough stuff into the sky to make a difference. When you get see it from that vantage point, it's very obvious that you could see the stuff being put into the atmosphere. And it's very, very easy to completely change our climate and our weather and our planet by what we pump into the atmosphere.
And it was I told you about my going to the climate reality leadership training with Al Gore, and he said the same thing. When you get up there and you see the world and the perspective, something has to change. And I mean, this is a totally random question. Look what you're doing. Look how you're leading. Look at the people that are around you. I mean, I think it's interesting that Jane Poynter and Tabor McCollum were Biospherians. Mm-hmm. So they learned a lot in there when they were being sequestered.
Well, it's called Worldview for a reason,
yes,
right?
Yes.
That's written into our DNA.
Yeah, Mark Kelly, right?
Sure.
And certainly a name that everybody in Tucson knows, Gabby Gifford's mm-hmm. spouse and an astronaut. Mm-hmm. So the worldview, is that a way to, biosphere was the Earth and you were in space and in the ocean. Is that the collaborative opportunity to take all that and help as a solution? Is that your vision?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're not... Worldview is not a tourism company, I don't think.
Got it.
I think Worldview is a...
Don't get that at all.
Yeah, Worldview is a perspective company. Yeah. We are offering a new perspective on our planet.
New paradigm.
New paradigm. Yeah.
New paradigm. It's great. So all of this impactful knowledge, the experiences, people working together. And I just have to talk about Rotary. I don't know how much you know about Rotary International, but it's really illustrative of putting things into action when we declared that we were going to put an end to polio. And it was a neutral organization, and we still haven't done it, even with, you know, I forget how many hundreds of millions of dollars we've gotten from Bill and Melinda Gates. But what we have done is promote international peace and understanding, because Rotarians were able to get into countries that were war zones and give out polio vaccines, like really, really, really tumultuous times in Afghanistan when things were very hot there, and places in Africa where there were, you know, wars. But we've almost eradicated polio. And that's an example of what you're talking about. We thought about what the problem is and how to solve it and found the commonalities. There's not a parent on the planet that wants their kid to have polio. So that was the common ground we found. And then there were ripple effects because of those partnerships. So I think it's another really great example. So what are you going to do with all of these people that you have connected with all over? Is there going to be a constellation forming? Did I really say that? It's like, what can we do? How can I segue this? And you can tease us a little bit about, it's really important though.
Yeah. So I think one of the key things to think about is this perspective, right? And our perspective as a human species changed abruptly on December 24th, 1968. That was the first moment where we as a human species saw the whole planet hanging in the blackness of space. As Apollo 8 rounded the dark side of the moon on that Christmas Eve orbit, the crew saw Earth rise. And what those ambassadors of all of humanity experience was the truth of that first Earthrise, the truth that we are one people traveling on one planet towards one common future. And so we have never really caught, in the 50 years since that moment, almost 50 years, we've not caught up to the meaning of that moment in history. And so we're starting an initiative that where we're framing a 100-year journey through space, a journey that began on that moment, December 24th, 1968, and that takes us to the year 2068. And we're asking people, what do they want the world to look like on December 24th, 2068? Not what type of technology will we have, but what type of principles do we as a civilization want to be operating under? What's the basic operating system of our civilization in 2068? And what do we have to do between now and there to get there? So because it's a mission in space, because, you know, people say they want to go to space. Well, you're in space already. Each and every one of us is on a spaceship.
It's we don't think of that. Yes. Yeah.
And you know, it makes you think about the life support systems on Spaceship Earth as well. But we're because it's a mission in space, every mission in space has a series of course corrections. And one of the most important course corrections is the mid-course correction. So this is where you look at where you are, so you have a really objective, truth-based, data-based view of where you are, where you want to go, and what you need to do to get there. And so our midpoint, our mid-course correction is 2018. So we're bringing together this group that's going to be led by a coalition of international astronauts from all around the world, people who have seen the planet with their own eyes from that vantage point. We're folding in visionaries and futurists and scientists and students and young people. And, you know, the MOOC is part of this. And we're offering a message of hope, a message of we can work together to create the world that we want to have. And we need to take a long-term vision on this. And so we're going to present this to the UN in September, to the UN General Assembly, and stay tuned. It's not really well known at the moment.
So I'm thrilled that you're sharing.
Everybody,
it here.
If you're listening, don't tell anybody.
Don't tell anybody. It's a secret.
But it's coming. It'll be coming out soon.
And how honored I am that you did share it with Mrs. Green's World and all of our wonderful tribe that cares deeply about things like this. And I'm putting it out there that I plan on being there, and I'm going to figure it out because I want to be a part of it. Everyone, I hope that you had the most incredible experience of the opportunity to just think and take a deep deeper cut and ask yourself, what can I do to be a part of the solution in this world? Because if enough of us think of it, the ripple will be felt around the world. This is our Earth Day show. Remember to celebrate Mother Earth every day. Our next show is with my friend Kevin Bonine, who's going to be talking about the great stuff we're going to be doing at Biosphere on the 22nd. And after that, just wait, you guys. This woman is named Ariel Greenwood, and she calls herself the Feral Agrarian. It's going to be a very interesting show. So, Ron Guerin, thank you, not just for all the work that you are doing to make an incredible difference, but for crossing my path so that I could stalk you in the parking lot.
Thank you, everybody, John.
Make it a great green, intentionally lived week, and thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World.